Get ready to whiten those knuckles and hold fast as we talk the most dangerous, daring, and epic sea stories ever told.
Whether facing ruthless men who prey on other mariners, or storms that turn calm seas into graveyards, those who go down to the sea and cast off lines enter the most challenging and dangerous environment on Earth.
Only here will you hear their stories and the lessons gained through their experience. I'm your host, Phil.
And I'm Bill.
And we welcome you aboard They Had to Go Out podcast. Before we dive into this episode, we need to provide a disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast are those of the individuals involved and are not to be construed as official or reflecting the views of any government agency or military service. This podcast is an independent effort with no government association.
When the most is expected, the brave men and women of the U.S. Coast Guard are always ready. The National Coast Guard Museum will engage, educate, and inspire visitors by honoring the courage and skill of our nation's unsung armed service. The museum will explore the Coast Guard's rich history and current impact through interactive exhibits, STEM-based learning experiences, and leadership development programming. Find out how you can join the effort. Become a plank owner today. Visit CoastGuardMuseum.org/out. That's CoastGuardMuseum.org/OUT.
One to check out is the Always Ready Collective, delivering art by and for daring fighters of the sea with their maritime-focused tattoo flash, pinups, and propaganda. Visit them on Facebook, Etsy, Instagram, and at alwaysreadycollective.com. Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Had to Go Out podcast. Thank you guys for joining us. Thanks for listening, liking, subscribing, sharing, doing all that social media stuff that gets the word out and gets us a bunch more listens and a lot more exposure for the National Coast Guard Museum. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, everybody, thanks for being here. If it's your first time, like Phil said, find us on social media, Instagram, YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, anywhere you can find podcasts, you can find us. Go to your browser, type in They Had to Go Out, you'll find us, and make sure to give us those 5-star reviews and subscribe.
Yep, hey, the reviews are what really makes it, and I didn't tell Bill, but last week we had the most downloads that we've ever got, so huge thanks to everybody for that.
Yeah, thank you. Somebody likes what we're doing.
Yeah, 10 people, right? That was the joke?
Right.
Yeah. Hey, and we've got an awesome one for you today. We've got a career mariner and lifelong bosun mate. We've got on the line Mr. Steve Denning, born in San Diego, California, joined the Coast Guard back in 1979 with recruit company Delta 128, going to recruit training out in Alameda. First unit out the gate was the Coast Guard Cutter Resolute, homeported in Astoria, Oregon. From there, bosun mate A school in Yorktown, and he went on to a slew of units for the next 20 years. Everything from Boating Safety Team Seattle, stations at Barnegat Light, Tillamook Bay, Los Angeles and Cape Disappointment, Pack Tacklet out in San Diego, and the Cutter's Fur, Bluebell, Point Judith, the Morro Bay when she was homeported in Yorktown, and finished out his career as chief of the boat on board the Coast Guard Cutter Laguerre in Portsmouth back in 1999. Also served as the XPO of Point Judith and the OIST of Station Los Angeles Long Beach. From there, worked a series of underway jobs, including a Catalina Island camp skipper, probably transporting people to and from wine mixers out there, because that's the only thing I know that happens in Catalina. and worked for the Harbor Patrol in SoCal, and then as a Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department dispatcher, retiring from that role in 2018, and officially retired now. With that, Stephen, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, Steve, welcome. I mean, after hearing your career history and talking to you a little bit before this, I'm really excited to ask this question because I'm sure it's going to be a good one. What is your most dangerous, daring, or epic sea story or stories?
Well, you know, the one that I still think about and does keep me up from time to time happened in 1994 on Memorial Day. And I'm going to talk to you guys about it, but just so you know, I don't really talk about this one very much. It's one that it still bothers me, although I'm real proud of what my crew did and our partners with L.A. County Fire and L.A. County Lifeguard. They were all fantastic, but not everybody went home that night, and so it's just one of those stories.
We appreciate you telling us, Steve.
You got it. You got it. So one of the things with the Port of Los Angeles and Port of Long Beach, at the time, I believe in 94, it was the busiest port in the world as far as tonnage. And so we were a pretty busy station with just 241 footers. We also had a 6-meter rigid hull inflatable, and we would you get tongue-tied sometimes, sorry. Sometimes we would have between 22 and 25 people on the crew, and so we were very busy. And so the night of have been May 30th, 1994, one of the things that my boss would later ask me, and it'll kind of make sense as we go along, was he called me in the next day after this call and said, "Chief, I need to know how you had 3 boats on scene in 20 minutes at midnight." And the only thing I could say is, "Captain, we were all there in 20 minutes because we were still working at midnight on Memorial Day." I had told the guys, this is the busiest weekend of the year. We're gonna protect the boaters in this area as best we can, and that's what we were doing.
Awesome. And you were the OIC there, right, Stephen?
I was the officer in charge, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and so we had actually been doing little towing here and there and some small SAR cases. And there was actually, at the time, it's probably changed now, so I don't want to throw anybody under the bus, but at the time, there was quite a methamphetamine problem in the port. And the main way that the smaller guys transported it was they would zip around to the different marinas all night long in small boats. And so one of the things that we were doing was we were stopping anybody, you know, between midnight and like 3 a.m. You know, and when I was with the sheriff's station, there was a pretty good saying, nothing really good is going on after 2. It's really more like after midnight. There's very little that's good.
Man, I think that's every non-rate who's ever worked for me exactly that. No story that chief wants to hear started after midnight.
Yeah, and that's whether it's sea or ashore in general.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, you shouldn't have been there, kid, is what you had probably yep. That one.
It's yep.
I think it was about 11 about 11:30 that evening, or 23:30 for you military types, we got a call from, at the time it was called Group LALB. They hadn't gone to sectors yet. So we got a call about 23:20, 23:30, something like that. We're getting, hearing that there might be some people in the water offshore from the port. And it was sort of that fog of information that happens right at the beginning of what turns out to be, you know, a pretty big deal. And so at the moment that we got that call, we had actually stopped 2 people. They had drugs with them. We were getting ready to make an arrest, and we just kind of froze the scene. We hit the pause button, and I had the 6-meter RHI, you know, just go see what's going on. And they started heading offshore. And then as we got verification, they started saying there's like 20 people in the water. And, you know, one of the things that they taught us at boarding officer school is you can arrest someone, but you can never unarrest them. But many years of experience and also with the sheriff's department, I found that actually you can do that. And it goes something like this. You know, I noticed that today is your birthday. And so what I want you to do is go on your merry way and sin no more.
Right.
And that's what they did. They took off, and the rest of us started heading about 2 miles offshore.
Those guys got home and told their friends that story, and nobody believed them.
Yep, for sure.
Yeah, there's no way to believe them.
When that was was that still like zero tolerance days too? I mean, it was basically we find you out there and your boat's getting seized on kind of on the spot.
It was after the golden years of that, but with meth, they hadn't California hadn't sort of decriminalized that like they do now, so it was still a pretty big deal.
Right. And then you as the OIC, Steve, what are you on board while you're out there?
I'm on one of the 41 footers.
Okay.
I like to give my boat coxswains wheel time, and so it was their boat. I was just kind of along as an extra set of hands. But of course, once it started, I started assuming the role of on scene commander. At least I would when I got there.
Right. Right. Okay. I love that initial tasking, like just get out there and get on scene.
let's just figure out what's going on. Yeah.
Yeah, there's nothing like having your own guys that you trust get out there. And I remember the young man who was driving that RHI, and he's still a friend of mine. I didn't get a chance to ask him permission to use his name, so I won't. But he is a longtime police officer with the El Segundo Police Department and just a super good guy. So I knew whatever was going on, he would very quickly get to the bottom of it and give me the skinny.
Right. Awesome. Yeah. So we're racing to the scene now, and all three boats are going because we figured out there's a lot of people in the water, right?
Right. So I'm being told this weird story now that a swimmer has come up to a commercial fishing boat as it's fishing and somehow didn't get killed by that fishing boat. And he's told him that his family and friends, including a bunch of kids, are hanging on to a boat and have been in the water now for 6 hours offshore.
Oh, God.
Wow.
So what we eventually will find out is the boat capsized about 6 p.m., and we didn't get on scene till just after midnight of that night. So we're talking about more than 6 hours and children as young as 10 months.
Wow.
So, yeah, I still get a big knot in my throat when I say that because I remember that baby who made it.
All right. Yeah.
Just take a big breath. I just
had. Yeah, that was good. No, that you just you just saved a whole lot of suspense right there, Stephen, for sure.
I think about her all the time. I know her name. I haven't contacted her, but I know she's 25 years old, and I know she's living her life, and I'm very happy about that.
What an awesome legacy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, I just can't to tell you how proud I am of the other Coast Guardsmen that I'm with. The men and women on those boats were so fantastic. They put away their emotions because you ended up seeing some things that you could freeze up. You could hesitate. And, man, it was like letting tigers out of a cage. There was no hesitation. And we're dashing off about 2 miles offshore from Angel's Gate outside of the Port of Los Angeles. And let me tell you about the boat we're going towards, and I think it'll tell a little bit of a story. This is a 21-foot open boat, which at one time had 19 people on board.
Oh, wow. 21
feet, 19 people, including little children, Now he didn't intend to be out after dark, so I won't ding the guy for that. But I think that's, if it's not overloaded, it's sure close. And, you know, wow. Three different families were represented in those 19. And of the 19, 14 were children.
Wow. Yeah.
Wow.
So it goes over, apparently, a wave of some kind, they say, splashed them. Dad told everybody to run to the other side of the boat, which would have been, what, two steps?
Right.
Anyway.
Right, right.
And they did that, and it goes over.
Hmm.
And so no time for a radio call. Couldn't grab the flares. They have some life jackets that they're holding on to. And so they're basically just holding on with one arm, the adults, and trying to keep the kids up with the other.
And did the boat sink outright, or is it just capsized, Stephen?
Yeah, it's just upside down. Yep. You know, no use to them except to hold on to.
Right.
The water temperature, going back in the records, was 65 degrees, which isn't too cold, but after, you know, 5 hours, 6 hours.
That's very cold after that long, for sure.
Brutal. That's brutal. It's just brutal. So let's see. It went over the dad of the family that owns the boat. Apparently was a swimmer in high school. And he made it about 3/4 of a mile to this commercial boat that was actually going back and forth fishing, which is pretty miraculous, I think.
Yeah, when you said he was lucky to survive, I mean, you think about fishing boat at night, lines, nets, whatever's out there. Yeah, that's, you're right. I mean, very lucky. You know, that's the one boat you probably, you'd have to be a little desperate to approach in dark.
Bringing another boat alongside a fishing boat is kind of a hairy experience. And I know we've all done it multiple times, but that's kind of a pucker factor. I can't imagine trying to swim up to one. The adrenaline that guy must have felt was probably amazing.
Yeah, the timing had to be perfect, because if he got, you know, a bath the beam or whatever we used to say, then he's looking at nets or hooks or something really bad.
Right. Yeah.
And, and the fisherman, he's the unknown hero in all this. He saw somebody in the dark, just ahead, with the diesels running and given, you know, direction maybe to his crew, and he heard somebody yelling for help. That's a miracle.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So anyway, we are getting there on scene, and the 6-meter RHI, you know, those things can just fly, and they get there, and they confirm our worst fears. It is, you know, just a complete catastrophe out there, and they're just freezing, and so they're just grabbing people up out of the water as quick as they can. Second 41 gets there, and he's doing that, and we're almost there, and the group, obviously, we're the biggest game in town now, and we're setting up a triage area. That would have been Base San Pedro, on the other side of the street from the federal prison there, on that beautiful island. And so we had everybody in the world heading to the triage, and we also had fire boats and helicopters, and although pretty much everything was taken care of by the time they got there. But it is very comforting to see all those rotating blue lights making their way to you. You know,
for sure. Yeah,
those guys are just total pros.
Yeah, it's impressive how quick everybody just answers the call and heads that direction.
Yeah, there are people wherever you guys are. there are people that aren't going to be sleeping tonight, and they're just waiting by a phone or by an alarm, and they just go. And you know, for a brief time in my life, I got to be one of those guys, and I'm proud of it. But I tell you what, that night, that particular crew that I was with, and they stepped up, and I'm proud of them. So the immediate problem we had getting on scene was getting a proper head count. It became a daunting task, and it was fully on my shoulders. But the adult who was in charge of the trip was the guy who had swam away. So he wasn't there to talk to, and he was in bad shape anyway. And so trying to figure out how many people had been in the water, they had drifted apart to some degree, so there were clumps of survivors, and now I have a boat with patients on board heading for the triage, and so they're trying to interview people who are just getting wrapped up in a wool blanket and shivering, you know, uncontrollably.
Right.
And so it became impossible. And I just remember being on the radio with group LALD and saying, okay, we got everybody. And then somebody would call us and say, you know, I don't see what's his name or what's her name. And okay, stand by. You know, I don't know if it's 18, 19, or 20 is the total. And it was real frustrating that night to get that head count.
Sounds chaotic.
It was it was real chaotic.
He's like, and, to say the least.
Right.
Yeah. So in the end, we being me, I guess, I realized that not everyone was accounted for. We were one short, and there was just after trying to get a head count, I don't know how many times, I just came to the conclusion, we're one short. Mm-hmm. We are one short. And LA County lifeguards, I think, sent a diver down from a helicopter, looked under the boat, and they did find a child under there. So not everybody got to go home that night, but
right.
I do remember just we got back, and I remember we got that boat flipped over, and we got it back in the moorings there at Station LA, which is co-located with Base San Pedro, and got the whole crew together and just told them, you guys did a fantastic job. And of course they were, some of the guys had been in, you know, 1 year, 5 years, hadn't lost someone on a call.
Right.
It's always tough, but that first one is double tough. And
for sure. Yeah.
And it was a child.
Right.
And so, you know, guys were crying and guys were angry. You know, they were angry. Who thought about putting 19 people in a 21-foot boat? And I said, listen, maybe the guy that did that made a mistake, but that was his son. So we're not saying anything.
Right.
You know, that's not for us. And I need to mention that there's a medical detachment at Base San Pedro. And I don't know who thought of it at the group. I'm sure glad they did. They were actually the first medical people, a bunch of corpsmen. And wow, fantastic to see what they, you know, they had the triage completely set, lit, O2 out there, you know. And so when the ambulances started showing up, people were packaged and ready to go.
Right. So, wow, that's impressive and always good to hear. I know we as bosun mates, we always give the corpsmen a hard time, but when push comes to shove, they are very good at their job where we actually need them, for sure.
Absolutely. I couldn't have been happier with them. One of the images in my mind is one of the corpsmen with the 10-month-old. And she is, you know, swaddled up in this, in the green wool blankets that we always had. And
we still have the same ones, Steve.
Yeah, no, I don't think anything's changed on that one, Steve. Yeah.
You know, you have a good thing. Why change it?
Right.
Right.
And the baby had the oxygen mask on, and you're like, oh, you know, for Christ's sake, that's a rough deal. But she made it. Another child went to ICU with her, but they both survived it. That is probably the roughest SAR case. I have certainly the most people involved to be rescued.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who notified the parents, Stephen?
What's that?
Who notified the parents?
Well, the parents were all there.
They were all there, yeah. So, I mean, you as the OIC, you know, once you got back to shore, was that part of your task to level the news?
You know, things happened so fast. When we got back, there were probably... you had the medical people from the base. You had probably a full engine company from LA County, and people were gone.
Yeah.
People on their way to the hospital. And, you know, certainly we wanted some blood tests drawn that I know didn't actually happen. But our slice of the pie had already been done, and we had to be satisfied that, you know, at midnight on a holiday evening, we're there in 20 minutes offshore on scene and picking people up. And in the end, that's what I have to point to for that evening.
For sure.
I mean, it sounds like you guys really couldn't have done any better given the situation, you know, that unfortunately you had that one that you didn't get. But if you're saying that the child was under the boat, there's, you never even would have known, right?
Right. We didn't know. We were trying to get that head count. And in any case, we're a small boat station, no diver. You know, I couldn't ask one of my guys to, you know, do a dive. You can't, right. Just can't. So we had to wait for the diver, and I know that fireman started CPR in the water, and it, you know, he didn't know that the child had been down there for many hours. They went on the assumption there's a chance, and those guys are just awesome.
Man, we work with some awesome people, don't we, Steve? I mean, just thinking absolutely. About, you know, like, just always go with the positive, right? Even if he had no idea and just there was a chance. So I'm going to do what I can. I love it.
Yeah. You know, and this is a 3-year-old, and the truth is they're tough critters, and sometimes they come back, and you've just got to throw the rules out and go until somebody, you know, taps you on the shoulder.
Right.
Right.
And I know that panic moment you're talking about when you have, you know, mass casualties in the water, it almost feels like a panic internal when you realize, man, I wish we would have got the count sooner. Or I wish we had that one guy that swam to the fishing boat so he could really give us the full head count. It's definitely when you realize that becomes your new mission, just figuring out, did we get everyone? Tough situation.
That was the critical part of my job that night, was getting the head count. And, you know, a lot of times the Coast Guard mostly gets there on time, and sometimes we don't. But in this case, I think I'm pretty clear that this little guy passed away many hours before we even got the call.
Right.
And so there was nothing to have been done.
Right.
I mean, I'll just say, Steve, listening to it, I could still hear your voice, you know, how much it affected you. But I want to say this without it coming out sounding trite, but like you really earned that extra couple of bucks of OIC pay that day. I mean, what a responsibility to kind of have on your shoulders, all those people and on your whole crew right there at the same time.
Well, I remember being pretty enthusiastic about the extra $100 a month.
right.
But as it turns out, it's not that much. The crew that night, my XPO, who is now a sheriff in the state of Colorado, probably half of those guys are on the job somewhere in a uniform. We're still in touch to some degree. Just a good group of people.
Very cool. Was that your first command tour, Stephen?
My first and last.
First and last.
I guess I was so doggone good. Let's not try to do that again.
Let's just go out on a good note.
I went from there to Morro Bay and then to the Laguerre. And I remember being upset about, and I don't want to go back to a big ship. And I'd always heard you could, fight your orders, this kind of thing. And I always, to be honest, and it may not be fair, I kind of looked down on that idea. And I thought about doing that, and it turned out that last ship, I had 50 young people in my department and chief of the boat. It was probably the most fun I had in my career, and that was a good crew as well. I've been blessed to have a lot of work with a lot of good people.
And where was the Laguerre out of?
They were out of Portsmouth. They would do Caribbean trips. I keep up with those guys, what they're doing, and sometimes go to Europe. Those guys get around and do a lot of things. We did Haitian ops, and that was quite a thing to do too.
Yeah, any mass rescues down there with the Haitians?
Well, we ended up finding a bunch of folks, probably. I'm going to say 50 or 60 on a little sailboat, and they'd already gotten attacked by, and my kids and now my grandkids make fun of this. They'd already been attacked by the Pirates of the Caribbean and, no Johnny Depp involved apparently.
Right.
And, we put them on the boat had to take them, back, which isn't what they wanted, but, a lot of them were in rough shape. And again, Bill, we were talking about the corpsman, the one corpsman on that boat, he was a lifesaver for those people.
Yeah.
Man, it's so funny. Yeah, like, for all the hate and discontent corpsman caused on the paperwork side of things, and then they come through in a clutch, and you got to respect the guys,
Yeah. I mean, yeah, for sure. Having served on a big white one myself, the experience that sometimes you feel like you have the corpsman at the clinic, those guys and gals that are the independent duty out there on the ships are they're heroes every day. The stuff that they do, whether it's migrants or detainees, almost every one of them has some kind of medical condition, and they don't have any, real history on them, obviously, because we just pulled them out of the water. And the job they do on those people day in and day out is really impressive.
Yeah, they get called doc, and it may seem a little pretentious, but they are the doc. And those folks, probably 75% of them had active cases of AIDS, and including the little ones. And the doc he worked his butt off, and there's not a lot you can do, but you can do something, and that's what the Coast Guard does. We do what we can.
Yep.
And having been in command, Stephen, and then you're the chief of the boat, what you got any advice for anybody out there now that's chief of the boat or might be in that position? That's a pretty unique role. Because you're splitting those communities between the enlisted and then the, you know, the commissioned staff on the ship. Can you talk to that a little bit?
Well, my experience as an officer in charge was, I would say, hot and cold, high highs and low lows, might be the, how I would put it. It was the hardest I've ever worked. And in some cases, pretty satisfying, but, you know, we talk about being away from home a little bit, on the tacklet, but, you're not home that much, as an officer in charge. And when you are, the phone just never quits ringing.
Right.
If we have time for a funny story, I got a couple of funny ones.
Oh yeah. Let's hear it.
Absolutely.
So I get a phone call in the middle of the night. I'm officer in charge in LA and it's one of my OODs, but it's the one who's the character. You know what I mean? He's a character.
Yep.
And he says, Chief, turn the TV on channel 4. And I'm like, okay. And I go in and I'm turning the TV off, and they're interviewing some gal on TV. And here he is. He's in the background. He's the guy waving in the background. I was like, dude, can you hear me? Yeah, Chief, yeah. Quit waving.
Yep.
Step out of the camera. And he says, do you recognize this lady? She makes adult films. They're interviewing her. And I went, I don't recognize her. How do you recognize her?
Nice. Good reply.
And the whole time you're hoping he's not wearing a Coast Guard Station LALB shirt in the background at the same time.
Sure,
right?
He sure is, right?
For sure he is.
He sure is. Step out of the camera range. This is a funny story. Tell me tomorrow. Good night.
So right. That's good.
And the same station when OJ did his low speed chase with the white Bronco.
Oh yeah.
I got a call. I'm in my soccer mom van with my family, and it's the group, and they say, "Hey, are you watching news about OJ?" And I went, "Yeah, something. I don't know." He says, "Yeah, they think he's going to Santa Monica to get in his boat. So we need you guys to get out there." Well, I'm going down like PCH way too fast, because I'm like, maybe my station gets to arrest OJ.
Yeah.
And this is going to be fantastic.
Right.
And of course he didn't get that far, and I'm glad he didn't, but, it was a funny job. A bit different than being chief of the boat. Chief of the boat, you're just the intermediary. You know, you're the guy between the command and the crew. And it's a much better job. Let me tell you, chief of the boat, I recommend it highly. Be the chief of the boat. Other than the officer in charge. I think a lot of people do officer in charge better than me. My wife and I talk about this, and I've decided after many years of being in the game, I'm a better second in command guy and the command guy. And it's just the way it is. And, I've faced up to it, and I'm not ashamed of it. And with, chief of the boat, you know, you got all kinds of people that you can,
you got layers on every side, right?
You got layers upon layers.
Yeah.
Well, and Steve, question for you. Cause I mean, I feel this, and I've never been in OIC obviously, but, I feel like on the big white boats, you get to still be a bosun mate as your primary job, as opposed to, like, you know, an XPO at a station or even an officer in charge. You're a little bit of everything. You're a little bit of an SK. You're a little bit of a yeoman. You're a little bit of everything. Whereas
maybe a little corpsman, even a little corpsman.
Yeah,
in there.
Maybe a little corpsman. You get to really be like, concentrate on your bosun mate craft when you're on a bigger cutter that has all the other support rates with it.
You really can. You can concentrate on mentoring your junior petty officers and getting them ready to advance. If you're an officer in charge, you've got procurement and you've got personnel issues, and you've got a boss that you had better please, and it's tough. It's a very political job. I'm not a great politician. I think I'm a pretty good bosun's mate, but my boss from that time would say I'm not a good politician as well.
You're like, yeah, but sir, I got the guy out of the background with the adult film star, you know, like, hey, come on, exactly. Dude, you should get some brownie points for that at least.
Right. So as the chief of the boat, one day in the chief's mess, I get a call from the chief cook, a nice lady. And obviously she's always in the chief's mess and we're good friends. And she calls me up. She has quite an attitude. Chief, I'm not going to take it. I don't have to take it. It's not my job to do this. And I'm like, Roger that, copy that. What are we talking about? Right. Your people in the deck department want me to deliver their food to their TV room. And I went, well, that'll never happen. Hey, I'm sorry. Let me go see what's going on. And I go down and I open the door and it's a tiny little room. And I got about 20 people in it. And they're mostly covered in aluminum foil and strange outfits. And I'm like, guys, first of all, why do we want the chief cook to deliver food? I'm like, chief, we can't leave the capsule. And I went, what? No, we can't leave the capsule. And I look, and they had two movies that they watched endlessly. One was Grease, and one was Apollo 13.
Oh, man.
And they're like, we're in the capsule. And I went, well, somebody needs to make a spacewalk. Because if I get another call from the chief, we're going to have problems. Just go get the food.
It's amazing the stuff you do to entertain yourself on those long patrols, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, what a great group of people. And, yeah.
That's a good story. That was good. Well, Steve, take us way back to the beginning. What was your first case that you ever ran, whether on the cutter or at the station?
Let's see, my first one that didn't turn out to happen. I was breaking in as a boat coxswain at Station Barnegat Light, New Jersey, and that is a pretty rough place, and those guys were running almost 1,000 SAR calls a year back then. It was before commercial assistance and all that. And so I'm almost done with my coxswain qual, and I'm actually off that day, and we're in front of the station. I got a baby stroller and my beautiful wife next to me, and we're walking. And here come these two guys, and I hear the SAR alarm going off, and they're running towards me. And I'm like, well, this is weird. And they get up to me and said, hey, everybody's on a call, and you need to go offshore. There's a barge going up on some rocks. And I went, what? And so now I leave the baby stroller with the wife, and I'm jogging with these guys toward a 44-footer. And they're having me sign my qualification letter. I'm like, is this a little fast, fellas?
Hey, needs of the service, needs of the service.
Yeah, right. No, just sign here on the dotted line. And I get in there, and I got my Mustang suit on. I'm sitting in a 44-footer, engine's idling, and I'm pretty nervous. And luckily, I think that the BMC, who is the XBO, and is still a good friend of mine, he heard about what was going on, and he put the kibosh on this thing hard. And I think they had an 82 from somewhere head for that barge, as they should have. And so I was able to, at a place where they have that many calls, you're running a lot of very low priority SAR, which are just reps. You're just getting reps and reps, and I'm doing toes and toes and toes, and you know, three or four a day, and feeling comfortable. And so later on, you know, that really pays off. And these days it's a little different with commercial assistance. Near the end of my career, they weren't doing that. And I don't know what's going on now. I'm sure they've they've somehow fixed the problem. So I don't want to throw my own guys in under the bus. But for a long time before I retired, they just couldn't get that much experience. You can't continue to tow the other 44 or 47 footer with those great cleats and bits and be ready for that rotten wooden sailboat. You know, how you going to set that tow up is a lot different. So
Barnegat light is very important.
Yeah. I one of the things my chief pointed out to me as we were transitioning was the old guard, you had a qualification book that was about a quarter of an inch thick. The problem was the only way to get it finished was to get the chief's signature, and that was double tough. That was just not going to happen until he knew you were ready. Now you've got a qualification book. It looks a little like the New York City phone book would look if we still had phone books. And we got a lot of hard chargers in the Coast Guard, and you get people that are going around all day, every day, getting things signed off. And then they're qualified. So I don't know what system is better. I'm going to say the new system's better because that's what my Coast Guard says it is. But I have my doubts, to be honest. You were ready when the chief says you're ready, and you knew you were ready. When that guy signed that book, he went, man, I don't know how I survived it, but now I'm really a boat driver.
We've got a lot more of this episode to go, and we'll get right back to it after this short ad from our sponsor. We're going to give you a key number about the future National Coast Guard Museum, and that number is 5.
There are 5 theme storylines: lifesavers around the globe, enforcers on the seas, defenders of our nation, champions of commerce, and protectors of the environment.
The exhibits and galleries in those storylines will be showcased in a 5-story museum.
And here's our favorite 5. For as little as $5 a month, you can be a plank owner and support construction of the National Coast Guard Museum.
For details on how you can get involved, go to coastguardmuseum.org/out. That's coastguardmuseum.org/OUT.
I'm going to say, you know, you've still got to get through that board and check ride, and you've still got to show that officer in charge officer in charge, really, that they can trust you. Now, granted, it's going to be simulated, but we still try to have some checks and balances in there.
Although, absolutely. Yeah. I'm sure there is. There's we always have good people, but I noticed that the size of the book, the number of pages, has increased exponentially.
It has, and I will tell you that if you look through it, it's sometimes difficult to determine kind of what's applicable to you. Because everything for every boat type is in there, and you know, there's some stuff you have to do for one boat type that you don't necessarily have to do for another boat type based on size and things like that. So it's a confusing process at times.
It is. I remember very well getting that book signed off the first time, and I'd probably been doing calls on my own as the boat coxswain for a few months, and I did lose someone on a call in New Jersey, and once in a while you'll see this on the news where a boat with an outboard will get stuck doing circles, doing big donuts. You know, you've seen those, and so I got, that was one of my very first calls, and I'd done a few tows, and I get out there, and there's probably 100 boats, a very busy boating area, 100 boats in this huge circle watching this aluminum skiff do donuts. And there's a guy kind of just flopping around in there. And I go up to to one of the boats that's watching and go, what's going on here? And a Marine, New Jersey Marine Police had tried to come alongside. The skiff had rowed up over the gunwale of the police boat and hurt a policeman very badly. And so they're gone. And so now here I am, you know, one of the greenest Coast Guard boat coxswains in the service, probably. In fact, I would venture to say the greenest. And this is my call now.
Now it's time to be an ocean cowboy. Is that what you're thinking? Is. Yeah.
You know, well, what I learned was, that, you know, we have some very young folks with us, and I had about an 18-year-old kid from New Jersey, and you have to be. These guys are great. I mean, I love these guys. They will take a 50-foot a roll of fire hose in one hand and a dewatering pump in the other. Maybe their hair's on fire and they'll jump onto a boat and they love it. You know, I actually never did love that part of it. And so I'm trying to catch up to this boat doing its donuts. And you know, when you're on the outside, you can never quite catch up. And finally I didn't even tell the guy to go. And so he shouldn't have gone. But right about 4 feet in between us, and we're moving, and he jumped. This kid just jumped over there, turned the engine off, boom, and now you know
we hero got moment, set. Hero moment right there, right? You just
And it really it's something I always remember because when I was mentored at Cape Disappointment by the surfman there that. And again, I didn't get a chance to talk to anybody, so I'm not using a name. But he said, Steve, when you get on, before you get on scene, you look your crew in the eye and you tell them what they will do and what they won't do because they are heroes and they will do it unless you tell them not to. And so at Cape Disappointment, it's a place where Coast Guardsmen can really get hurt or killed. On kind of a regular basis, unfortunately. And so he would say, look him in the eye. You will not jump on that boat until I tell you to, you know? And so it's one of those stories. Yeah, I'm glad he did it in New Jersey and I didn't tell him not to, but, you got to watch out for the younger folks. Cause again, 50 foot roll of fire hose, a dewatering pump and their hair's on fire. They're ready to go. Yeah, ready to go.
Yeah, and for you, I mean, that's you're one of the few people that can claim that that it worked out first shot. You know, I mean, I just saw, I think a few right. months ago there was a video out of Seattle, and it was an RBM maybe with the boat doing the same thing, and it was, I mean, that's a tough thing to do, you know, to get in there and try and stop a boat that's going in a circle at speed on plane.
It really is. You have very few. Very few options. You can try to put a line in the prop, and I think, man, if you're that close, you might want to try something else. But you know what? This kid solved it for me.
Yeah. Really. You know that the lesson from that surfman's a great one. I think just to that's good advice. Tell them what they will and won't do.
Yeah, I think that's really a good point, Steve. That you know we rarely have to tell people to do something when it comes to an emergency situation. A lot of times the farther up you get, your job is actually to throttle people back and protect them from themselves. Cause all of our people are, their bias is towards action and there's a problem. I'm going to go fix the problem.
Absolutely. And this, BMC that I took over for him as the BMC at Cape Disappointment. He'd spent a lot of time with me. We'd go up to the tower, the lookout tower, and watch boats towing another boat in. And he said, if you don't like what you see down there, you head them offshore. They make huge, you know, a huge circle. And you keep them out all night if you have to. And they're going to be cold and hungry and miserable. And what I'm asking you to do is not care, but you don't have to call their wife and tell them that something happened. And that's what I did. I took pretty much everything he said to heart. You know, he taught me some nuance that I just hadn't had. You know, you're coming up to a boat that is taking on water, and he said, everybody's busy. You got a minute. You're driving up to it. Start counting how many seconds from one roll all the way to the other roll. Count how many seconds it goes from, you know, dipping on the starboard to dipping on the port. And if that's slowing down, you're continuing to flood. And that's where we get in trouble in the Coast Guard, is we want to pump water so badly. You know, if we can only get a dewatering pump down there, that's when we get in trouble. So, he'd have me counting the rolls on the boat. And sometimes it's just time to get the people off the boat. Maybe we're not going to save it. We want to, you know, but you can't always save the boat. Save the people, though.
Again, great advice.
Yeah, that's.
I like this guy. We need one of those at every unit.
Right.
You have to make a lot of mistakes to get where
that's,
I was.
That's true. Hey, you can tell there was a lot of experience.
I made
behind,
a lot of mistakes.
A lot of experience.
Yeah, I've made a lot of mistakes. I don't feel like I've gotten the wisdom yet, though. Maybe I got to make a few more.
You know, the thing about a fishing boat or something like that, we don't want to endanger lives to save property. But that fishing boat is no different than your local barber shop or your bakery or someone's restaurant. It's someone's dream. That's a business, and we do want to save it, but we can't save it at the price of human life. Can't do it.
Yep. Which is a harder call to make sometimes than, you know, the way it's easier to say than to do, right? When somebody's there, they're emotional. They're begging you to save the boat. It definitely ups the ante a little bit.
Well, there's even at Cape Disappointment, and those guys, I have so much respect for what they do. And there are places on that bar they will not go during certain times of the year for a rescue. And I had to get underway on one of those. And my crew was putting on their dry suits, and they are getting ready to rescue somebody. They're going to go into whatever. And I said, guys, we're not going in there. You don't understand. We're going to get to the other side of that area. And if they make it out of there, if they get spit out of there, we're going to grab them up. Other than that, I'm not calling your wife or your husband tonight and tell them you didn't make it. Not going to do it. And it is a tough call, because that I'm aware that commercial boat is someone's, you know, dream of success.
It's somebody's livelihood, right? Like,
absolutely. Yeah. You know, it's everything. You know, it's the fireman rushing to a restaurant that's burning. He wants to save it, but sometimes you can't.
Yeah, great points all around. Were you a surfman, Stephen?
Well, you know, I almost don't want to say yes. I'm going to say yes. You know, here's the thing. Let me, a little controversy here on the show. I made Surfman when I was at Station Tillamook, and I went to Cape Disappointment and made E7, and was the BMC there generally is a surfman, and you are always on the backup boat, and that's what I did. But years later, they started this numbering system, and I guess I just haven't looked into it enough. In 84 or 85, whenever I was told, yeah, you're a surfman now, you've done what you need to do that, but there was no list of I'm making a lot of people mad now. I'm sorry, you guys.
That's okay. Hey, whatever drives traffic, it's good.
Yeah,
okay. Well, no, but you, I mean, you got the pedigree. You were at all the right units. You were obviously you must have been confident to advance to E7 and then get a follow up surf station. So I can't imagine. I mean, everything points to yes, you were a surfman. That's why I asked. I thought the answer was just going to be yes. You know what I mean?
You know, the thing is, with all the stolen valor stuff, you have to be kind of careful.
Yeah.
And so I was told I was a surfman on 44s, 30, the old 30-foot SRB, and the 52-foot motor lifeboats, And so, but my name isn't up on the wall at the Motor Lifeboat School. So I don't know. Hmm. Maybe it was, maybe I wasn't.
you were more of a surfer than me, I'll say that for sure.
thanks.
Well, let's see. So we were talking about your time in Aton, Stephen, and Bill got really excited. So you wanna run down like any crazy stories from your time on Black Holes?
Well,
did you eat a bully critter?
No, man, those guys are brutal. No, I didn't do that. They all back in the day, they were all tobacco chewers.
They still
yeah, nothing changed.
Yeah, let's be honest.
I decided I want to be like those guys, and so I got a bag of tobacco and I took it home, and you know I tried it when nobody was around, and dude, I couldn't hang. I mean, I'm dizzy, I'm puking, and I'm like, man, I'm not doing that. On the fur, I think it was a BM3, just working on the buoy deck. They did run me over with the ship once, and it seemed to me when I was buoy jumping and changing the light bulbs on the, they used to have light bulbs. I don't know if they still do. I don't.
They're LEDs now. It's been in the last like 10 years we've converted to LEDs on them nowadays.
Yeah. It's four bolts, Steven. Yep. You take off four bolts and you just replace it now. And
then you need to know how to work the universal remote.
Yeah. That was the next part. There's a sweet little remote where you just plug some numbers in or something or move a arrow.
Holy smokes. Well, what I remember was there's something called a CG6P lamp changer.
Yeah.
Yes, there was.
Remember, it had six little light bulbs and it would ratchet around.
Yep.
And we would change that, and here comes the fur to do something, and I'm in the middle of the cage kind of thing. I don't even remember the name of the buoy parts and stuff, but they literally, I think, went right over the top of me, and I thought, well, they're going to be happy I'm not dead. And so when I finally came back above water, because I was completely underwater, they hit me with a fire hose. I'm like...
just for good measure.
I'm still alive, and they hit me with a straight stream fire hose. I'm like, well, that's cool.
That sounds about right, Steve. When I was on a black hole, we ran over a buoy with two guys in the cage, kind of like that. And as we're going over it, the BM1 at the time is yelling, "Hey, you better not scratch the stripe on the way by."
Yeah.
Is that a thing? Is that are you guys like running people over intentionally just to break them in and meet the neighbors?
No, ours was a computer malfunction because it was a 175 with the computer got a brain of its own for a minute.
Code speak for keel hauling people, basically.
I don't.
I'm guessing Steve's was they let an ensign drive. Probably that's probably why he got run over.
Yeah, man, that was a good crew. We had some fun. I don't really have any Eton stories other than I got those stories I couldn't get in my own rack.
Yeah,
that's kind of it.
Well, see, now no one in the audience can say that I didn't give Eton some love because I've gotten a few messages that we never talk Eton, but we just did. Steve didn't have any stories.
We absolutely did.
Yeah.
I even said Coast Guard 6P lamp changers.
You did, yeah. So we even got technical, right?
Boom.
Yeah.
I love it.
And all the young guys listening are going to have to go look that up.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, they're going, okay. They're saying okay, boomer, right about now.
right.
Well, that used to be a PQS item, right? Or RPQ or whatever.
You said PQS, I can't believe it.
Yeah.
Oh Lord, have mercy.
Yeah, that was a BM3 prac once upon a time.
Yeah, so, yeah.
Next, we can explain to all the kids that there used to be car batteries inside buoys.
Yeah, we aim, and they used really to just be disposed of in the water.
Yep. I missed those days, but I car batteries.
We used to throw trash over the side too on the cutters.
Different world.
Yeah.
What Stephen, when you were at Pack Tacklet, talk to us about that if you would.
Sure. So Pack Area Tacklet, basically they have detachments assigned, usually four enlisted and one officer, and you He deployed with Navy units, and we were the South team while I was there for about 4 years. And we so we had a translator on our group, and we would just go out and bring our Pelican cases of guns and gyro stabilized binoculars and all this stuff. And I think I rode on, I figured, 57 different Navy ships.
Wow. Yeah, that's a,
over that 4 years.
Wow, one 4 year tour. Yeah, that's a lot of deployments.
Well, I was whining the other day on a forum that I had just found with a guy, because I had gotten in from about a 6 week deployment on Friday, and they told me Monday morning you're back underway. And on Saturday, the day you're off, you get to deploy with the San Diego Marine Police just to keep your, you know, keep your touch in.
Yeah.
I'm like, are you kidding me? That's nothing. I was whining about that, and a guy that was also at Tacklet just as I left, younger than myself, he said, Steve, I got to tell you, I got in on a boat after about a month underway, and I got underway on the pier next to when I got off 3 hours later. And I'm like, well, I got to shut up with this wine and stuff.
Yeah, right. That, man, they worked you guys hard back in the day.
It was awful.
How far south did you guys go?
How far south? We went as far as the Galapagos, I think.
Oh yeah, that's okay. Wow.
So we did the cross in the line ceremony with the USS Bristol County, and all I remember from that memorable day is the another Navy sailor yelling, "There's that Coastie BM-1, get him!"
Yep.
Unbelievable.
That was just jealousy. He was jealous he wasn't a BM-1 in the Coast Guard.
Yeah, that must have been it. And I did actually see Davy Jones. I saw the Royal, the Royal Staff or whatever they were, the barber.
Yep.
And there were actual dogs, guard dogs, that looked a lot like formerly drunken Navy sailors.
That's awesome.
Yes.
That's crazy.
So the Tacklet was it was a grind. A lot of marriages didn't make it. And I think it was Admiral Applegate later said something that I tried to tell younger Coast Guardsmen, as the pressure of the career can do one of two things in a very general sense, very broad brush. One is the stress of it will completely blow up the marriage, your relationships, and you're done. Or for some people, it's kind of an implosion, and it's like taking an open hand and you make a fist, and that's you and your family, and you're not going to get a divorce, you're not breaking up, it doesn't matter what happens, you are basically invincible. And you can make that decision. And some people, unfortunately, they do lose their marriages, but I'm a big believer in trying to keep families together and doing whatever needs to be done. But Tacklet, I'll tell you what, Tacklet gave us a run for the money. 275 days underway a year, and that was something.
Yeah, you got to say the big center of that rock's probably the one back home, I would say.
Yeah, well, right?
Without a doubt, yeah. Without a doubt. We laugh about it. For a long time, we would get in a big, horrible argument the day I was leaving, and it took us a while to figure out what was going on. Is that we just hated to be apart so much that we had to do that. You know, if you're happy with each other and then you separate, that's even worse somehow.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that's
if you don't like each other, it's pretty easy. No, I get it. Yeah,
yeah, I think that's a that's a common thing, because 3 days later, everybody's walking around the ship like, man, the last thing I did was had a fight with my wife before I left. And then you feel bad about it. And there go the emails about what a horrible person I am, and I'm so sorry. Yeah, it's a pretty common thing.
There's a lot of experience on the line right now.
You know, back in the day, of course, they didn't have the electronics that they do now. So we were doing the snail mail.
Right. Oh, yeah, yeah.
We got in a big argument about some stupid thing. You know, it was probably money. It always is. And she would always have, we've been married about 41 years now, but she would have the kids always write me. And so we hit Liberty Port somewhere, probably in Mexico or Panama. There's no mail. And we go to the next place. There's no mail. And I'm like, man, I guess this is it. And the guys have been on me this whole time. Steve, why aren't you going out with us, dude? Your wife's not even writing you a letter. Hey, okay. Thanks, fellas.
Right. Thanks, right. Guys. So
finally, I'm kind of giving in, and we're in Panama City at Base Rodman.
Well, if you're going to give in, that's the place to give in, I would say.
You know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying? And so I got my going out clothes. This is not a drill. I'm going out, Jack. And our officer had gotten a little bit ill and replaced by the XO. And here comes the XO. And I see him coming down the pier, get this big box along with all his other stuff. And there's like tubes of paper sticking out all over him. What the heck is that? And here it comes. I got crayon drawings. I got letters. It's been following me around for weeks. And I start taking my going out clothes off. I'm like, fellas, you're on your own. Be careful. I'm staying here.
Good man.
I'm a barracks rat. I'm a barracks rat when it comes
to that. Nick of time, huh?
Oh, yeah. I mean, here he come. And, of course, I didn't know he was going to enlist me in the Miss Pollywog contest just about a week later. I'm not sure your listeners are ready for that. But anyway.
Yeah. Did you win? That's the real question.
No. The scary thing is, there were guys trying to win. I was completely hideous. Yes,
that was great. Well, Steven, what you have any busts from Tackle you could talk about?
Let's see. You know, there's a couple, but I don't think I can talk about them.
What was the big drug? Exactly. What was the drug back then? Was it marijuana? Was it cocaine? What were they running up the? Because I mean,
either one.
Yeah.
Yeah, either one. And this was the golden era of, you said it earlier. Any little amount.
Yeah.
And you were dead meat. I do remember we were actually back in town, and they had us. You know, we're in for the weekend, and they have us out doing boardings on a Saturday. And there was a boat that was at a marina, and they told us to do a boarding. And it turns out the engine on this boat hasn't run in years. And I'm looking at my guys going, you know, there are some real jurisdictional issues here. Basically we shouldn't be doing this. And, but the boss said, do it. And, you know, it wasn't exactly like the My Lai massacre. So I'm going to do it. And we go on.
I like what you equated it to. That was
right.
Yeah. I mean, that's the extreme, right? Well, it's not that.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you're told to do something, is one thing, but if it's the My Lai massacre, you have to say no.
Yeah, you got to wait. All right. Hey, at least you got your hard line. You know, you know the hard line.
You know, there's some gray. So here's a 16-year-old pregnant girl on the boat, big pregnant, and the guy's about 20, and he's brainless. We're trying to talk to him, and he's basically brainless. And we find a little bit of marijuana. And this, again, was the time when boats were being seized for a joint, really. And they say, yeah, seize the boat, by all means. I said, well, it's not a conveyance. It doesn't move. He said, it could be towed. I'm like, well, doggone, I didn't think of that.
Right.
So I seized the boat and all of its content. And we weren't even on a boat. We came there in one of those stylish 15-person government vehicles. You know the ones, the huge van.
Oh, yeah.
We're piling into the van and turn around. And these are guys that I've been all over the world with. And I'm like, does anybody feel good about this? And they're like, no, this is horrible. We don't care about the guy. He was an idiot. But this woman is now homeless. And I went, here's the deal, fellas. From now on, something like this happens, you and I, we huddle up. We're going to decide what the course of action is. That's it. And if we decide that the course of action is to throw their marijuana cigarette into the sea and get back in the vehicle and go have lunch, then that's the course of action. And that's kind of how we ran it from then on. And probably hear some flame outs on that, but that's the way it was.
The best decisions occur on scene, in my opinion.
Yeah, there's got to be some room for discretion, right?
Yeah, you can't tell me a boat that hasn't run in years is smuggling dope by the joint.
Right.
Don't tell me.
Yeah. And he obviously wasn't growing it on board, so that's
right. Yeah, that was a good.
That's crazy, Stephen. Of the 50, the 50 some Navy ships you were on, right? The mm-hmm. one of the most memorable stories to you was one where you learned a lesson from a patrol in a GV against a boat moored up, right? Unreal.
Yeah, that was completely inoperable.
Yeah.
Completely inoperable.
U.S. Coast Guard, man, you never know. Every day, something new.
Yeah, right.
The other one that I'm remembering is that we were off of the Sea of Cortez, and I don't remember the name of the ship. It may have been USS Howell. But I don't really remember for sure. And it's an American commercial fishing boat heading the wrong direction as far as we're concerned for smuggling purposes. And it's got cases and boxes and stuff with military markings on it. And we're like, what in the world is this? And we're looking at it, and we can clearly see that there are weapons. There's all kinds of stuff. It's so filled up, it's lashed to the deck. About 125-foot boat, actually imported out of New Orleans.
Oh, so she's U.S. flagged.
U.S. flagged.
Yeah.
Well, at least jurisdiction's easy at that point.
Yeah, you got her now.
Yeah, no more jurisdictional problems, and no crying pregnant woman. So. It was the one time at Taklet where we actually were all pretty nervous because we decided, based on nothing, that this has got to be mercenaries of some kind. We didn't know what it was. And so we just got together. We did our little huddle and go, here's the deal, fellas. At the end of this long day, we are going to be going home. Whether they go home is entirely up to them.
Right.
They are going to need to do everything we say because, again, we go home. And we almost, did blood brother thing. We were so scared we weren't messing around anymore. And we get over there. And, of course, you're always driven to the vessel by a Navy boat coxswain. And sometimes
that was probably the most dangerous part of the whole mission, man.
Yep, enough said.
That's what I'm trying not to say.
I'll say it for you.
Oh, man. And we always did our boardings the same way. We practiced all the time. And I was the boarding officer, and so I would be the last one on. So first guy on, he has his, you know, we have different fields of fire. We may not have been professionals, but we tried to act like them. And but unfortunately, the boat coxswain and the seas didn't cooperate, and I find myself on the boat first, and I'm by myself because he's got to make another run at the boat. And I just remember the crew just walking towards me. They're pretty calm. They're just walking towards me, but I'm so kind of jacked up with my idea that they're mercenaries. No, I black hole all of them and put them on their face.
Yep.
And now finally the guys get up there and we're talking to these guys, and we decide we're going to make this sweep through the boat, and we're making a sweep through the boat. And there's this, now we can see that they got 50 cal machine guns in boxes, and like, this is crazy. And we sweep through the boat, and we're about halfway done, and I get a call in my first gen earbud, and the warrant officer who's with us says, hey, get off the boat. Don't talk to anybody. You didn't see anything. You don't know anything. I'm like, what?
I'm imagining three little letters. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this was Ollie North's Contra
there affair. You go. Wow. Yeah. Nice.
Yeah. CIA was the first thing that popped in my head. Yeah. That's crazy.
And so I, you know, had been told don't say anything. So of course I strike up a conversation with the captain.
Yeah, you got to know now. Yeah, for right. Sure.
I said, dude, just tell me what's going on. You guys are CIA or was, he goes, man, I don't know what you're talking about. He was a Cajun from Louisiana. He said, we got loaded up at Concord Naval Weapons Station. We go down to Nicaragua. Those boys meet us and they escort us in. And we have a nice dinner, and then we leave. That's all.
That's awesome. What a story.
Once I got back, it became obvious that we had interrupted Ollie North's arms for hostages deal out of the White House basement. We had actually gotten a flash message to the Navy ship we were on telling us to get off that thing. And telling any Coast Guard units in the area not to stop southbound American commercial vessels, you know, in the future. So
again, man, U.S. Yeah, Coast Guard, you never know. You just right, never know what's right. Going to happen that day.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That just out wild. Here looking for drugs, and I found a weapons shipment.
Yeah, I found a little revolution. You're headed south.
Right.
Yeah, that's, first one to know about it.
That is wild.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Well, Steven, we're sitting in about an hour and a half or so. Man, we'd love to have you back on for a 20-year career. I'm sure that we could talk all day.
Stories.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like we barely scratched the surface.
Just let me know. I got a couple more good ones.
Hey, awesome.
All right.
Well, Steven, we so much appreciate your time today. We appreciate your service to this country. And wish you luck in retirement, and can't wait to have you back on and talk more.
Oh, very good. Thank you, fellas.
Before we end this, we want to give a plug for some people and organizations that we believe in.
The Coast Guard Foundation supports the brave men and women of the Coast Guard when they need it the most, providing everything from financial aid to families in crisis to scholarships and playground equipment. As a nonprofit 501c3 charity, they count on our donations to deliver this support. Visit CoastGuardFoundation.org. That's CoastGuardFoundation.org to read about their programs and donate what you can to support those who guard our nation's coast.
Thanks for taking the time to listen.
If you like what this podcast is about and what we delivered, look us up at theyhadtogooout.com or your favorite podcast platform, and like, comment, subscribe, and share so we can keep the momentum up and do bigger things going forward.
Look for a new episode every Sunday. Until then, fair winds and following seas.